You guys know a lot about me, probably maybe more than you want to know at times. Something some of you may not know about me, though, is that I am the youngest in a family with 5 children. Mine is a big family, and we have quite the age span in my family. My eldest is my sibling, is my brother Dan, and he's actually 19 years older than I am. And then there's some others that come, and then the one who's closest to me is my sister Barb, and she's actually still 10 years older than I am. So you're probably all saying it in your heads right now, yes, that makes me the baby. And you know, honestly, there are good things and bad things about being the baby. I was blessed to have lots of time with my mom and dad, simply because they were older and they didn't have as much going on in their lives by the time I came along. And frankly, for most of my childhood, I was the only one left at home. So my mom didn't and dad didn't have to divide their time and attention between a whole raft of other children. It was all mine. And that was a good thing and a bad thing. I do count myself very lucky, though, because I got to do things and experience things with my mom and dad that my brothers and sisters didn't have a chance to. And I know I'm blessed for that. However, you could feel it coming, couldn't you? One of the frustrations of my place in the birth order in my family is that, funnily enough, my siblings seem to readily notice the perks of being the baby, but they all are a bit blind to the definite downside. Although my mom and dad did have more time for me and with me, they were older, and so they didn't have as much energy as they'd had in their earlier years. And I spent a fair amount of time with reasonable and at times unreasonable fears about my parents' declining health. I was well aware that they were getting older. And my siblings would remind me of that when I was being a bit too trying for them. And the downside that persists even today, I have, I am, and I suspect I always will be seen by my family as the baby. No matter how old I get, I turned 50 last year. I am still the baby. I can tell by the looks on their faces. They don't say it out loud anymore, but there's times when they look at me and go, "Diane, grow up." Grow up. Those are words we find ourselves almost spitting when we're frustrated with someone's lack of maturity, don't we? It's interesting because that's actually what Paul's saying to his friends in Corinth through our text today. In all of those words, he's saying, grow up. Now, you know, we say this all the time. Reading just this passage alone in isolation is not a good idea. As always, especially with a text like this one that's part of a larger letter, we need to see it in the larger context. We need to think about who wrote it, who they were writing to, what their relationship was, and what made them pick up the quill and write in the first place. Well, as Phil outlined for us a few weeks ago when he preached on an earlier passage from this letter, it was actually written by the Apostle Paul to the church he had planted in the city of Corinth. Paul had planted that church in that city, but it was unusual because he actually spent quite a long period of time with them. He spent a year and a half with them, helping them to establish their work there. He only spent more time than that in one other place he planted a church. Normally he didn't stick around very long, but these guys he lived with for a while. After he moved on to continue his missionary journeys and plant churches in other places, Paul continued to care for these people. And he did that largely by way of sending messengers or letters to them. He would receive a report from someone who had been through Corinth. And he would hear about how they were doing because he cared and he wanted to hear how they were doing. And sometimes he would hear reports of issues they were having, some difficulty they were facing, and so he would write them a letter offering them counsel and guidance. Biblical scholars have actually found evidence of way more than 2 letters that he wrote to the Corinthians. In fact, it's a bit confusing because we call this one 1 Corinthians. That's just because it's the first one that appears in the Bible. It was not the first letter Paul wrote to them. And it's really important for us to know that, that it's part of an ongoing string of correspondence that he had with them. That helps us to understand why here, right near at the beginning of this letter, there's such a tone of frustration, isn't there? He's frustrated with them. Well, in this letter alone, Paul's actually addressing 11 issues he's heard about going on in that church community, things that are disrupting their community. And goodness only knows what he'd been addressing in previous letters. So they're well into their relationship with him in this way. You know, Paul is often portrayed as having been kind of harsh and a bit grumpy and curmudgeonly, precisely because of texts like this one. They kind of pulsate with frustration. But when you step back and you look at the span of his relationship with these people, you can see why he would have been frustrated. I think he must have felt like he wasn't getting very far very fast. He knew them well. He'd lived with them for quite a while, and he loved them deeply. And so quite reasonably, he is frustrated. They seem to be straying off course, and he knows there are dangers for them in that. And so he's trying to correct them, to bring them back onto the way of Jesus, onto the course to life. Well, at first reading or hearing of our passage today, it can be easy to think that what he's addressing is some divisions that have developed as people in Corinth have allied themselves behind various church leaders. Some people in Corinth were really clear. Paul was the father of their church. He planted it. He was the founder, and they were with Paul. But Paul had left, and rightly, some other leaders had risen after he'd gone, in particular, a new preacher. He was supposed to be something else. His name was Apollos. He was known for having this deep understanding of the Old Testament scriptures. And he had a passion for Christ and a boldness of preaching the gospel. People said he was incredibly charismatic and eloquent, which is actually something Paul wasn't known for. And so Apollos was becoming very sought out and popular. He was the guy you wanted to go hear. And so it wasn't long before some of the people in the Corinthian church were starting to say, you know, I actually belong with Apollos. Some people were saying he was even better than the Apostle Peter. That's something. Well, as can happen in churches with multiple leaders or strings of leaders, sometimes people's loyalties set the stage for these kinds of divisions to develop. And that seems to be what had happened in Corinth. Paul had heard reports from people who had visited the city. And he'd heard that the situation there had actually deteriorated to the point that they were becoming known for their quarreling and their jealousy. The whole situation was not good. The divisions were disrupting the unity of their fellowship, and that was damaging their ability to live out the mission Jesus had for them in their city. Who wants to become part of a group of people who are more known for their infighting than for any good that they're doing? And so Paul called them on these divisions and on the foolishness of them. But wise as Paul was, he realized the divisions were not the real problem. They were just a symptom. The real issue is what he addresses right at the beginning of our passage today in verses 1 and 2. I'm going to read it from the Message translation because it lays it bare. But for right now, friends, I'm completely frustrated by your unspiritual dealings with each other and God. You're acting like infants in relation to Christ, capable of nothing much more than nursing at the breast. When Paul had left the Corinthians, he realized that they were young. They were just starting in their walk with Jesus, infants, he called them. But now, we think this was at least 5 years later, The reports he's hearing seem to indicate that they have not grown much beyond that. In his deep frustration, he says that it is this lack of maturity that is actually the real problem. Now, don't worry. I didn't pick this text because we have a problem. It's actually a lectionary text, and it's good for us to dig what we can need for us out of it. So let me allay your fears. And what there is for us in this text, I think, is a focus on maturity. The concept of maturity is absolutely central in Christian discipleship. And yet, it's one of those aspects of the Christian faith that can seem a bit nebulous to us. Spiritual maturity can be really difficult to define in words, and even more impossible to try to measure or quantify in any way. It'd be great if it was like our chronological age, if we could just say, you know, I've been following Jesus for 10 years, and so naturally I look like a 10-year-old Christian, and I behave like a 10-year-old Christian. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to always work that way. That's exactly why the Corinthians were having the problems that they were. While our physical maturing kind of seems to be written into our DNA, it happens without us giving it much conscious thought. Our spiritual maturing isn't like that. We have to be very intentional about it. We have to work at it. And we have to watch for it in ourselves and in each other. But can you see the problem? If we can't clearly measure it, and there's not some easy definition of it, then how exactly are we supposed to watch for it? How do we know what we're shooting for? I remember early on in my walk with Jesus, not long after I came here, wondering why churches didn't seem to offer kind of a standard series of courses for you to take. You know, you decide to follow Jesus, and then you go in the hall and you sign up for Christianity 101. And when you're finished that one, if you liked it and it went well, you go on and you take 201, maybe 301. It seemed to make sense to me. That was the model I was used to. That's what we do in our age and society. We decide that we're going to undertake to learn something or to develop some part of ourselves, and we either take a course, or if you're a little bit more independently minded, you rush off to the closest bookstore and you buy the latest book on it and you try to teach yourself. But you know, as God would have it, for this faith thing to work in Christianity, he hasn't really given us courses so much as he's given us companions. That's what makes the difference. Since the very beginning, when Jesus said to those first disciples, "Follow me," growth in this Christian life has been learned by joining together with other people and following Jesus. It's the way it happens. In part by following the example of others who have walked ahead of us, through whose lives God has so beautifully given life to others. And you know, whether our companions are people who we know and talk with regularly, or people we learn about by studying their lives, reading their stories, their examples give us clues to follow as we each make our own way in following Jesus. You can find books that talk about spiritual maturity. I'm not saying that's a bad idea. It's a great idea. And you can do a Google search. If you type in spiritual maturity, enter, what's going to come up is a whole bunch of articles and blog posts and stuff, most of them with lists of descriptors of spiritual maturity. There's a wide variety of them, far too many for me to go into today. But they include things like not letting the highs and lows of life get in the way of your relationship with God. Like being able to find richness and God's presence in the ordinariness of daily life. Or being able to be at peace, even in situations that are beyond your control. Those lists can be really helpful, because they give us ideas of what spiritual maturity looks like, and they give us things that we can actually do a little bit of self-assessment on. But in the end, it's not lists. It's the lives of others that can really be the most helpful people who have given us this glimpse of what the mature Christian life looks like. Through their lives, we get a vision, a bit of a vision of the promised land, and then we can live towards that. Now, while I was preparing this sermon, I came across lots of stories of the lives of saints. One simple one really stood out for me, though. It was the story of an Eastern Orthodox monk who was revered by his brothers in the monastery for his extraordinarily holy life. His was a life they followed closely, and they looked to as an example to try to live towards themselves. It's said that on his deathbed, this monk was given a vision from God. It was quite the vision, it seems. It was a vision of God, of angels, of heaven, the whole shebang. After he had that experience, that vision, the other monks who were standing around his bed and had been watching him asked him for a word of wisdom. And you know, all he could say after that incredible encounter with the holy was this: "I've only just begun." This great man of faith who had dedicated his entire life to living for God, he seemed to have come so far, and he was known and followed so closely by others. On his deathbed, after living that devoted life, he realized that all of the growth he had experienced to that point, and it was significant, it was but a drop in the ocean of all that God had yet to bring him. Doesn't that profound humility ring with truth for you? It seems true and right. It is a strange paradox of the Christian life that sometimes the most important step we can take towards maturity is acknowledging our own lack of it. It's an important step. I said a few minutes ago that part of the way we grow is by following the examples of the lives of others who have walked ahead of us, which would suggest, if you think about it, that the Corinthians weren't really wrong in trying to follow Paul or Apollos closely. Following the examples of leaders like those two is not a bad thing to do. The destructive divisiveness and quarreling that the church was becoming known for arose not because people followed one or the others of those men, but rather because they had forgotten that both Paul and Apollos were themselves just following Jesus. It wasn't Paul or Apollos who was making any of the incredible things that were happening in Corinth come about. It was God. It was all God. And Paul knew that, and Apollos knew it. I think that's part of what made him a great preacher. And as Paul realized when he wrote this letter, the Corinthians needed to be reminded of that foundational truth, as do we sometimes. I may plant, you may water, but we both know it's God who gives the growth. And that growth comes simply as we each try to follow Jesus faithfully. You know, the author of the letter to the Hebrews did a way better job of sharing this message than I've done here today. In chapter 11, he goes through this long list of the lives of great people of faith, reminding us of their stories, people like Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Moses. He's urging us to let those people be our companions, to remember and learn by the stories of their lives. But you know, he culminates it all by urging us to get on living as people of faith ourselves, by doing one central thing. He says, keep your eyes on Jesus, the one who both began and finished this race we're in. Study how he did it. So ultimately, friends, you will be moving towards maturity if you continue in the very same way you started out, by looking at Jesus' life, by learning from his example, and by listening. Listening each and every day to how he might be calling you to follow him today. So, what do you say we grow up? Amen.